industrial accidents,
ancient
solving
poisoners,
crime,
poison
chemical
prevention.
Spills. This is Toxic History.
Judah Brown is a residency-trained clinical pharmacist specializing in emergency medicine, and Judah has extensive experience in guiding safe medication use at New York Presbyterian Columbia Hospital. I want to thank you for speaking today, Judah, and I'm going to hand the mic over to you.
All right. Thanks, Dr. Blumenberg, for that thoughtful introduction. And today, I invite you all to come on this journey with me, exploring thalidomide's fall from grace and subsequent reclaim to fame that ultimately had a lasting impact on the safe therapeutic medication supply worldwide. So fortunately, or maybe unfortunately, I guess, depending on how you look at it, I don't have any conflicts of interest to disclose regarding any of the contents of the presentation today. However, I may discuss some off-label indications of medications currently used in the United States, which I think may be the nature of any medical history presentation. Though I'll mostly be taking us along a story through history, I will also be hitting some salient points that emphasize the impacts of this tragedy, notably reviewing the therapeutic uses and scientific rationale for thalidomide, both then and now. I'll also explore the dominoes that fell that led to the thalidomide tragedy and the barriers that led to the delay in recognition of drug toxicity. Lastly, we'll evaluate the regulations that ensued globally in the aftermath of this disaster. Our story starts in 1954, when thalidomide was originally created and marketed by the small German pharmaceutical company, Chemie Grünenthal. In the 1950s, it was a wild time for drug development worldwide. Not only were there massive needs for medications, but there was also a huge economic boom with global economies rising substantially. In fact, in the 1950s, especially amidst the World War era, global pharmaceutical industry grew substantially and was a game of marketing and competition, with little regulation governing the production of therapeutic concoctions. But let's dive a little deeper. Chemie Grünenthal was just one of numerous small chemical pharmaceutical companies aiming to make it big in the post-war era. Like many others, the small firm started and explored antimicrobials like penicillin and attempted to modify molecules in order to create a therapeutic blockbuster of its own. In the 1950s, after the war, the demand for sedative hypnotics and sleeping agents rose sharply. Between 10 and 15% of prescriptions at the time were for diazepam or barbiturates. However, these agents were widely known to have additional untoward effects that circulated amongst the public domain. At the time, particularly in Germany, where medication regulation was sparse and most drugs to cure most ailments were available to the general public without the supervision of a physician and could be purchased over the counter. In fact, trends in medication use, almost similarly to the current American pharmaceutical landscape, were largely derived from direct-to-consumer marketing, which served as the largest marker of the success of a product. In the infancy of the German drug company, Grünenthal had a small scientific division headed by Dr. Heinrich Mukder. Trying to take advantage of the lucrative sleep aid market at the time, the company enlisted the help of a staff chemist, Wilhelm Kunz, whom was also a pharmacist by training. In 1954, thalidomide was synthesized by Kunz and an associate chemist, Dr. Herbert Keller, noting the superficial structural similarities to diazepam and barbiturates. Incidentally, the drug was developed as a byproduct of already performed research on glutamic acid. But at the time, both Mukder and Kunz were convinced that these similarities were enough to elicit the same pharmacodynamic response as other drugs already on the market. Though, as both you and I can see, and as a pharmacist by training, which I'd say I only have a mild amount of medicinal chemistry training, neither an enantiomer of thalidomide is truly structurally similar to benzodiazepines or barbiturates. The key here was that the creators also believed the drug would not have the hangover or risk of dependency. As I'll continue to emphasize here, hint, hint, wink, wink, the absence of standardized testing for new molecules was impressive. At the time, particularly in Europe and Germany, drugs should have been tested against valid controls and must have had minimal variability to support positive findings. At the time, simple animal testing were used. Specifically for thalidomide, doctors Kunz and Heller used a complex series of testing on rodents that demonstrated absence of reflexes in the setting of noxious stimuli, and from there asserted that the drug itself was sedating. The jiggle cage test is what was used, and essentially they suspended mice in a cage over sulfuric acid. If the mice moved, electrodes at the bottom of the cage would be dipped into the sulfuric acid bath, producing hydrogen gas. The mice administered thalidomide, less hydrogen gas was produced, meaning less movement overall from the mice, thus the claim for sedative hypnotic activity was accepted. Now, unsurprisingly, this was essentially the only testing performed prior to mass marketing of the product by Grünenthal. However, there were other compounds at the time being developed by other European drug companies. In fact, meprobamate, shocker, another sedative, was under development by Wallace Laboratories, who performed toxicology studies in rats, being among the first to introduce the concept of teratogenicity. They conducted a 15-month study where they exposed mice, were mated, and offspring were examined for any external or internal physiological defects. We'll come back to this whole animal experiment thing in a few moments because it will prove pivotal later on in the story. But looking back, there were about 25 compounds in development worldwide, simultaneous to thalidomide, that investigated toxic effects, particularly in fetuses and in pregnancy. So drug-induced teratogenicity wasn't a new concept, though testing and assessment may have been lackluster. Thus, in 1957, thalidomide was marketed under the brand Contergan and sold throughout Europe and Asia until 1961. It was generally marketed as a sleep aid and sedative. However, after much appeal, it began to be used in pregnant women to mitigate nausea and vomiting, notably early in pregnancy. And it was effective. It quickly picked up steam for this off-label indication in pregnant women for its perceived superior efficacy to other pharmacological and non-pharmacological agents at the time. And not to mention, or I guess re-mention for that matter, that this was available over the counter. So much of the popularity was owed in part to its easy access without a prescription. What made this even more perplexing, though, was at the time, the mechanism by which thalidomide reduced nausea and vomiting was not known. Clinicians proposed that this was due to its sedation and anxiolytic effects, but there was no definitive data that this was true. In fact, there were minimal to no peer-reviewed clinical studies on the efficacy for nausea and vomiting treatment or prevention. However, its use spread rampantly among pregnant patients, making its claim to fame, which would later be defamed, as a workhorse drug for morning sickness. Ominously, American drug manufacturer Smith, Kline, and French, who explored marketing the agent in North America, reported that thalidomide had no tranquilizing potential, no antihistaminergic activity, and in fact, no antiemetic activity at all. Even more specifically, Kimi Grünenthal licensed their newfound wonder drug to Richardson Merrill, a U.S.-based drug company for which the medical director, Dr. Pogue, and consultant obstetrician, Dr. Nolson, agreed to try the agent in pregnant patients, though never published the results of their investigation. Over 14.6 tons of drug were sold by 1960, including up to about 5 million German patients. 1961 marks the year of scandal, or I guess when truth came to light. However, seemingly I skipped over some key points that also occurred between 1954 and 1961. As I'll continue to emphasize, thalidomide was at the time an over-the-counter product, and its use had grown substantially in pregnant women, not just as a sedative hypnotic. So let's just spend a few minutes there. So in 1958, the use of thalidomide outside of Germany started to pick up steam. Particularly in the UK, Australia, and New Zealand, the Distillers Company, a biochemicals and manufacturing agency, marketed thalidomide under the brand names Distival, Tensival, Valgrain, and Asmaval. More shockingly, without any scientific evidence, UK branding claimed, and I quote, Distival can be given with complete safety to pregnant women and nursing mothers without adverse effects on the mother or child. In fact, sample packets of the drug were given out to physicians to feel free to distribute to their patients suffering from morning sickness. Not long after the commercial release of thalidomide, the testing that wasn't performed pre-release got some real phase four treatment. Patients and providers around the world started reporting the development of peripheral neuropathy temporarily associated with the thalidomide use. Now, I'll mention here also that thalidomide did not have great uptake in the U.S. North America, given more stringent regulations by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. In fact, the FDA denied its new drug application in 1961 based on lack of safety data at the time, most notably citing the neurologic toxicities and peripheral neuritis, not as much the lack of teratogenicity testing, but we'll get to that in a few. Meanwhile, independent reports of presumably associated toxicities in pregnant patients and their newborn infants were continuing to pop up. Australian physician Dr. William McBride cited several cases that he presumed to be due to thalidomide. He then notified the distillers, the Australian manufacturer, of the temporal relation and possible association. Subsequently, Dr. Wilhelm Linz from Germany collected another 14 cases demonstrating a relationship between the German thalidomide brand Contergan and the development of fecalimia, or absent extremities including hands, feet, arms, and legs that were developed in newborn infants of his patients. Reported case indices continued to rise through about 1961, as you can see here. In fact, Dr. McBride not only reported his findings to distillers in Australia, he sought to publish his findings and elicit global feedback through his letter in The Lancet in 1961 that you can see here. Based on the patients he cared for alone, Dr. McBride noticed a 20% rate of infants born with fecalimia, which was astoundingly high compared to the previously reported rate of congenital abnormalities of about 1.5%. As you can see depicted here, infants were primarily born with long bone abnormalities, typically under development and deformities. Additionally, there were several observations of esophageal, duodenal, and anal atresias, and several cardiac abnormalities. And based on the reported accounts, approximately 40% of infants affected died within a year of birth. Dr. McBride also attempted to correlate temporal correlation to type of deformity present, stating that ingestion within 24 to 36 days of the last menses was associated with the highest incidence of fetal malformation. Dr. Lenz affirmed his thoughts on this association, further specifying that even a single dose was associated with increased risk. After thousands of cases began rolling in through various sources, windows of exposure and temporal association became more clear. And in fact, in the early days of understanding teratogenicity, it became clear that the window of exposure in relation to pregnancy may be even more important than the quantity of cumulative dose administered. As shown, you can see the smattering of malformations based on days post-conception. Hip and long bone malformations were pervasive, though, amongst the entire exposure window. However, any story would not be interesting without a little bit of drama. So in retrospect, we now know that we can attribute a majority, if not all, of these defects to thalidomide. However, at the time, initial reports were not linked to and were actually denied to be due to thalidomide. This error in judgment led to continued utilization and many more exposures. After over 10,000 birth defects were reported, thalidomide was removed from the market in 1961 in the UK and in 1962 globally, and noted to be one of the largest man-made disasters in human history. However, a significant aftermath ensued. Who was responsible? Could this have been prevented? How did this happen? And how do we move forward? All questions that need answers. We'll attempt to answer one of those questions, though. I'm sure many of you toxicologists following along may be disheartened to hear. We don't know exactly why thalidomide was so toxic during pregnancy. As previously stated, the windows of toxic exposure were well understood and documented. We do know that exposure between that about 20 to 36 day window is highly associated with fetal malformation at any dose. However, outside of that window, exposure still poses significant risk. In rat models and in human reports, thalidomide exposure prior to 20 days is almost uniformly associated with miscarriage induction, and some experts hint that any pregnant patient exposed to thalidomide should expect some complication. Underlying mechanism, however, is still TBD. There have been several postulations and hypotheses ranging from DNA mutagenesis, inhibition of cellular adhesion, and direct neural toxicity, but probably the most salient thought has to do with thalidomide's anti-angiogenic effects. We have a firm understanding in general that blood vessels are very important to fetal development, and interruption in the development and maturation of these vessels, especially early in embryonic development, definitely has some potential for significant downstream effects. Anti-angiogenesis in this regard results in lasting teratogenicity. As depicted here on the right, in one animal model, chickens this time, demonstrated that embryos exposed to thalidomide and its byproducts exhibited blood vessel destruction within 1 hour of exposure. This then led to limb signaling gene expression during the cell and vascular death observations. Ultimately, these bird embryos demonstrated what Lenz and Helms also witnessed, abnormal limb development if the embryo survived. A small silver lining in this monstrous tragedy were its limitations to Europe, Asia, and Oceania. In the United States, who at the time had more stringent regulations surrounding drug marketing and development, did not approve the use of thalidomide. Dr. Francis Kelsey, an FDA review officer, was the personnel responsible to review the new drug application for thalidomide after its initial successes in Germany and the UK. As a physician and pharmacologist, Dr. Kelsey denied approval, citing lack of safety data, focusing mostly on the emerging cases of neurologic toxicity from European patients. Her efforts prevented the marketing and sale of thalidomide in the United States, averting more significant impact in terms of affected patients. After thousands of cases of thalidomide embryopathy were uncovered, Dr. Kelsey was awarded a Presidential Award for Distinguished Federal Civilian Service in 1962 by President John F. Kennedy. Notably, Dr. Kelsey's achievements led to the passage of the Kefauver-Harris Amendment of the Food and Drug and Cosmetic Act within the United States. While not totally due to thalidomide, the disaster pushed President Kennedy to sign the act into law. Essentially, these amendments established our tiered system of knowledge generation requiring for medication approvals, including phase 1, 2, and 3 clinical trials. Even more importantly, the Act established the necessity for drug manufacturers to prove safety and efficacy in human patients prior to marketing them within the United States. Within the UK, the Medicines Act was passed in 1968, which authorized the supply and administration of prescription-only medications. Now for the drama. Though truly disheartening, around 60% of infants affected by thalidomide did survive. Grünenthal, as expected, in the wake of ginormous social disaster, created a foundation financing and supporting victims. Additionally, in Germany, at least, the Federal Kontergen Foundation was also founded to provide lifelong financial support to affected individuals. Kimi Grunenthal, Distillers, and Richardson Merrill all experienced some sort of litigation. The infamous thalidomide trial from 1968 to 1970 was probably the most complex of them all. Lasting several years, the trial served to investigate Grunenthal and its senior employees on the charges of homicide and injury in thousands of cases. Involving a multitude of witnesses and intense periods of investigation, given the length of the investigation, the trial was further complicated by death and illness of several of the indicted individuals. Ultimately, while focusing on whether the acts or omission of action of Grunenthal caused fetal deformities, no criminal proceedings sustained. The investigation found that taking thalidomide could result in neural damage and that the German pharmaceutical company had not met the requirements of a proper drug manufacturer. However, the court found it difficult to reach a definitive decision on culpability for the birth defect findings. I know, a little shocking, but somewhat not surprising given the regulations for drug development at the time. Additionally, the court acknowledged the prompt removal from market once claims about teratogenicity were made. Grunenthal was ordered to pay 110 million German marks to affected victims and terminated the case. Similar civil actions were brought about to Distillers Company with similar results. Though a huge tragedy, safer drug production is monumental results. Thalidomide now does have actual therapeutic indications and has been used safely, but that's a story for another time. Thank you all for listening to this Toxic History, and please don't hesitate to reach out with any questions. Thank you.